Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crom. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear from Louisville Mayor Jerry Abramson. He delivered his State of the City address recently.
Now, I discussed some of these briefly at the inauguration speech that I gave 3 weeks ago, but since George Gill didn't come to my inauguration, I figured that I would at least bring them up again and provide him an opportunity to... I know. You used to be somebody. I remember. But for those of you who don't know George Gill, he was an outstanding publisher of the Courier Journal years ago.
But first, the president of Shell Oil Company says there are no easy solutions for ensuring an energy supply for the future. John Hoffmeister was in Louisville recently to deliver a speech to the World Affairs Council of Kentucky and Southern Indiana and the Kentucky World Trade Center. He spoke with WFPL's Julie Goodwin.
What is the biggest challenge we face in the U.S. concerning our energy supply?
I think the biggest challenge is recognizing that there's no silver bullet. There is no one answer, no single solution that's going to meet either the short or the long-term demands. Having said that, the most immediate thing we can do to meet energy security requirements of the future is to provide access to more conventional oil and gas resources. We know there are some 75 billion barrels of oil and gas resources in the Outer Continental Shelf and on federal lands to which the oil industry is restricted from accessing. We greatly appreciate the Congress's actions in December of 2006 to open up 8+ million acres in the Gulf of Mexico. It's the first opening in 25 years, and that's helpful, but that's not enough. The estimates are, you know, this is not a huge area of resource when there are so many other areas of resource for conventional oil and gas. Other alternatives will take longer, but the short-term needs of the nation could be met better by more access.
So more access. What else needs to be done to meet this challenge of providing an energy supply for the future?
I think over the longer term, development of unconventional resources such as oil shale, conversion from pulverized coal to coal gasification technology, IGCC, integrated gas combined cycle, where we can gasify the nation's huge abundant coal resources. I think increased supply of liquefied natural gas called LNG, which comes from stranded gas locations around the world, shipped in here in liquid form and then regasified. I also think biofuels and other alternatives are important for the future. Shell's very active in biofuels and investing heavily in cellulosic ethanol, for example. But in addition, we're active in solar, wind, and hydrogen fuel cell technology. These are longer-term plays. But I think we have to recognize we will be part of a hydrocarbon economy for a long time to come. The alternatives, no matter how hard we work, no matter how fast we work, we don't replace 100 years of oil and gas infrastructure and supply chain overnight.
Talking a little bit about coal resources, this is obviously one of Kentucky's main interests. How would Kentucky fare in such research and development of clean coal technology?
I think we're actually beyond the research and development stage. I think we're at the production stage. Shell, for example, has coal gasification facilities in China, in Europe, and working on a proposal in Australia. And we're actually working on several proposals here in the United States. I think the technology is developed. It's robust. I think it's a matter of choice. And what are the conditions under which those choices get made? And that, of course, means... that's a question for utilities, it's a question for government leadership, it's a question for public utility commissions, and then whether it's the Shell gasification technology or some other company's technology, I think we can move forward right now.
Concerning alternative fuels such as biofuel and things like that, you've mentioned a little bit about some exploration with those and Shell's commitment to that. That obviously being the big topic, what additional things do you think need to be done? I mean, is this not a major push for Shell at this point?
It certainly is a major push for Shell. Our research efforts are going into three different kinds of ethanol production, one based on straw, working with a partner in Canada, one based on gasification of biomass, such as wood chips, with a partner in Germany, and another, a municipal waste treatment of enzyme research, which could turn municipal waste into ethanol. The reason we're not concentrating on the food chain at the moment is we don't think that there's enough available food product, and so we are interested in the massive quantities of other biomass. But in the meantime, we are distributing corn-based ethanol, and are probably one of the world's largest distributors of such ethanol. But our research and development and future partnerships and production possibilities will be more in the cellulosic ethanol arena.
And what does this mean for consumers in both the short and long terms?
In the short term, consumers are seeing that the supply is catching up with their demand. That's what we've seen in the fall off of prices in the last 4 or 5 months, where the industry has mostly recovered from the effects of the hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico in 2005. And so we're seeing a better equilibrium between supply and demand, which has brought down the retail price. The crude price is still volatile. The crude price is still high. We don't see anything changing in the various factors that are affecting the crude price. But as regards ethanol and biofuel production, we have to take that a step at a time. Current law requires us to get 7.5 billion gallons of ethanol under the Energy Act of 2005 by 2012. We're sure we'll meet that. And we are anticipating even more demand for ethanol, because 7.5 billion gallons represents only 5% of the motor fuel requirements of the nation. If we doubled it, it's still 10%, and it will take quite a long time to double it. But those efforts are underway to get to the 5% solution, and then we'll see what public policy says about whether we need to go further. And we'll also see what the market says, because we believe that it's actually better for the market to pull this product along than to have a legislative solution, because we have to keep in mind the economics. During most of 2006, gasoline was less expensive than ethanol. And ethanol is, on an agroeconomic comparative basis, still an expensive product, more expensive than gasoline.
What are some of the things that you've been hearing from other cities so far?
The most important conversations we've been having have to do with this whole price-profit discussion, in which our job is to get more supply to the marketplace, which has a beneficial effect on prices, let me put it that way. The second would be the keen interest in biofuels and alternatives such as solar and wind. What's also very interesting is the American the public that we've talked to in 18 cities, all are interested in what policymakers are going to do. And what steps will policymakers take in order to provide more energy security to the nation? So it really helps us know how to discuss these matters with policymakers, so that it doesn't look like we're just operating in our own selfish best interest, but actually operating in the interest of consumers across the country who are our customers.
That was WFPL's Julie Goodwin talking with Shell Oil Company President John Hofmeister. More information is available at our website. Go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619 under Select a Program. When we come back, we'll hear about future plans for Louisville and the mayor's State of the City address. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Coming up a little later in the show, we'll hear the second part of our series about critical thinking in Kentucky's higher education establishments.
If you wanted to go into politics, you could advance your career. If you wanted to go into law, or even if you were just in business, you could make your case in the assembly to win a contract, to win business from the state. And so that was the way to get ahead in society.
But first, during his State of the City address this month, Louisville Mayor Jerry Abramson outlined his agenda for improving the city. Among the efforts listed are a renewed commitment to begin the construction of two new bridges and the reconfiguration of Spaghetti Junction. Abramson delivered his speech during a weekly meeting of the Downtown Rotary Club.
You know, it's a pleasure to be back Somebody said, is this your 18th visit to the Rotary, the downtown Rotary for the State of the City? It is my 18th State of the City address, but I think we started this tradition only about 14 or 15 ago. So it's great to be here for either the 14th or 15th time, and it's really exciting to be able to speak about the state of our city for the 18th time. Now, I want to promise you that this speech is going to be different than the other 17 that you've heard in the past. I want to focus on more than just the usual litany of all the great things that we have done together throughout the year of 2006. Yes, it's a fact that the city of Louisville is financially sound and stable, as reflected not only by our balanced budget, but also by the excellent bond rating that we received from Wall Street. And yes, it's a fact that we were rated, once again, one of the nation's safest large cities in America, and our homicide rate for the second year in a row has gone down. And yes, it's a fact that we attracted at least 5,000 new jobs to Louisville this past year, with a net gain over the last 3.5 years, net gain of 15,000 new jobs. And yes, it's a fact that we've begun an ambitious plan to upgrade and modernize our urban firehouses and to build 3 new libraries in our community. And finally, yes, it's a fact that in 2006, that was the year that the dream came true. We consummated the deal to build the arena, and we also created an opportunity to make the front page, second section of the Wall Street Journal, when it had an article and had a description of 3 of the most exciting new buildings to be built anywhere in the world. One was in China, one was in Russia, and the Museum Plaza was along the riverbank here in Louisville, Kentucky. But today I want to talk more than just what we've done and the success stories. I want to talk with you about where we've got to focus tomorrow's. We've got to focus our energy and begin to think about 10 years out, 20 years out, year after year, day after day, to ensure that 10, 15, 20 years from now, what we do today will make the kind of difference to not only keep rooms like this full of men and women who want to engage in making their hometown better, but also make sure that our children and grandchildren fill these tables and tables like these across the community to be involved in their neighborhoods, in their faith-based organizations, in their community activities. In short, I want to talk about just 4 key issues that I think will ultimately be transformational. They will bring about they will be the catalyst that will literally bring about the change that, if we do it right this year and next year, 5 years, 10 years, 15 and 20 years from now, we'll be able to look back and say, we had the vision today, and 20 years from now, we delivered on that vision, and our kids and our grandkids are better off as a result. Now, I discussed some of these briefly at the inauguration speech that I gave 3 weeks ago, but since George Gill didn't come to my inauguration, I figured that I would at least bring them up again and provide him an opportunity to... I know. You used to be somebody. I remember. But for those of you who don't know George Gill, he was an outstanding publisher of the Courier Journal years ago. And president of this club. That's right. Today I want to move on, though, beyond the conversation that I started several weeks ago, and I want to see if I can energize you and others throughout this community to become my partners, to become advocates, to become focused on the importance of accomplishing what I think will be the 4 issues that ultimately can be transformational over the next 10, 15, 20 years. We've got to push the fast forward button. We've got to accelerate the way we go about doing things so that ultimately we can have 2 and 3 and 4 tracks all going at the same time, to ensure that we reach the goal that we want. And don't forget, we've had these types of experiences in the past. I mean, let's start, for example, when you talk about fruits of your labor, you know, we plant today and we literally move on tomorrow to be able to ensure that 5, 10, 15 years from now the blossoms occur from the seeds that we plant. Let's think about 3 or 4 of the issues that I think are important, and remember that we've done these things before. For example, Woody mentioned the park system. I would say to you a transformational approach that we're involved in right now is as a result of our predecessors 100 years ago looking out around the country, finding Frederick Law Olmsted's landscape firm, saying, wouldn't it be great to develop new parks in Louisville that were just outstanding in nature, parkways that would interconnect those parks, and see if over 100 years we could create the surrounding neighborhoods that would reflect the kind of enjoyment of the park system and be sustainable neighborhoods that would upgrade and refurbish the kitchens and expand the rooms as to whatever modern today means for housing, because people want to stay around those green spaces. Now, they did that 100 years ago, and I would submit to you that we're embarking on that same plan now, so that 10, 20, 50 years from now, there'll be folks sitting in this room, standing at this mic, saying that we as a community in the year 2005 and 6 understood the importance of that and began to plant the seeds that ultimately will blossom down the road. We're going to add, thank you, sir. We're going to add thousands of acres of new parks over the next 10 years. We're going to literally be building 3 to 4 new parks along the 27-mile Floyd's Fork first phase of our City of Parks expansion, 3 to 4 Cherokee parks. Cherokee Park is 400 acres. To be able to create an opportunity that literally will give us the chance, along with the 100-mile loop around the city for bicyclists and walkers and joggers and maybe even horseback riders. We're looking at the potential of having part of that path focused in the horseback opportunities. All of that has begun last year, this year, with the vision of David Jones Sr., with the vision of Dan Jones, with their commitment to step up, step out, public money, the private money that they've been able to raise, and create a chance for us 100 years in the future to have our kids, great-grandkids and great-grandkids to really have the kind of enjoyment that we would want them to have. And the hope is, if we build those parks the way Olmsted built his parks, then the neighborhoods that spring up around them will also be sustainable. They'll be quality built, and they'll ultimately be able to be passed on from generation to generation because folks want to live near that green space. I would submit to you that that's a transformational activity. It's the kind of thing that we need to come together, as many of you have financially written checks to support this effort, as David Jones and Dan Jones have worked on raising the money. But the public money from the federal government, the public money that we're putting in at the city, the commitment of the private money, give it 10, 15, 20 years and see if that doesn't end up being transformational in terms of the future of Louisville, Kentucky. In fact, we've gotten to the point now that we're really becoming a signature city because there is no new park venture anywhere in America that literally is doing what we're doing in terms of the number of acres, in terms of the opportunity for recreational expansion, in terms of the development that will be available, all as a result of the City of Parks Initiative and the 21st Century Parks Fund. So be aware of it. Be involved in it. Watch for opportunities to be engaged in it. It will make a difference. A second issue that I think will make a difference is continuing the momentum that's been going on in downtown Louisville. The projects that have served as catalytic events that have created chances for investment and jobs to occur all around them. When you think about 20 years ago, we embarked on raising money for the waterfront. 20 years ago. And we're at a situation when we finish the Big Four Bridge, we will have completed the downtown waterfront development. And at the same time, about 10 years ago, we began dreaming about a baseball park downtown. And we built that Jewel Box Park. And that has ultimately, that along with the waterfront, has attracted $500 million of investment, contiguous and in the nearby vicinity, to support those wonderful investments, be it housing, be it offices, be it restaurants. It creates a chance for us to truly see that there's a direct triggering mechanism based on the investments we make on one day in terms of what happens the next. Look what we did on West Main Street. We started investing in West Main Street in the 80s. The Science Center was sitting there as the pioneer. We bought the old Carter Dry Goods building, and it sat there. And now it's Museum Row, it's Restaurant Row, it's got offices, it's got residential. And then 4th Street Live comes on, and now we're talking about where's the next iteration of an entertainment venue in the downtown. And what about retail? And what about opportunities for the kind of restaurants and activities that we all want? You have a chance now, we do as a community, to take the base that has been built and to continue focusing on and ensuring that The public-private partnerships that have got us this far will continue to expand and grow. And you got to remember this, folks, for those of you who are concerned about why so much focus on downtown. Never forget that what happens in downtown Louisville does not stay in downtown Louisville. Because what happens in downtown Louisville literally ripples out throughout the entire community. Study after study, city after city that was studied, shows that those cities that have a vibrant core have surrounding areas that do far much better in terms of economic development and quality of life than those cities that have a decaying core. So the opportunities for us to continue the momentum, to support the 24/7 that's happening right now in downtown Louisville is really important, and it has begun. You know, 9-to-5 workplace. You saw in the paper this morning, 9.5% vacancy rate in A space, office space in downtown Louisville. Arts and cultural district, convention hub, new hotels going up, residential neighborhoods. We're going to bring on another 2,000 homes over the next couple of years in downtown Louisville to go with the already existing 2,000 residential units. We've got a regional medical center, life science center, education center for students involved in college as well as high school. And the challenge is, now that we're planting those seeds, is to keep ensuring that those seeds are watered, that we're there to assist it to grow, so that 5 and 10 and 15 years from now, we'll be able to grow and expand. Third, transformation. I know bricks and mortar, build a building, develop a restaurant, those all play a role in terms of catalytic events. But I would submit to you, one of the real catalytic events that we need to focus on today to ensure there's a bright tomorrow is education. Now, we've got to, time and again, we talk about it a lot in this community, but we've got to step up, we've got to get involved in the lives of individuals and families through the educational chances that we lay out on the community's table for them. Whether it's early childhood, preschool, whether it's all the way through the public school system or the parochial or private school system, or whether it's all the way into the community college experience and the four-year universities. The bottom line is that the new jobs that we create and attract to our community will only be as good as the workforce that we have here. And so we have got to ensure that education is on the front agenda, the number one item on the agenda, that will create an opportunity for us to transform the future of Louisville. Partnerships, we have them all over the community. We're working on making sure our kids all read at grade level. We're working on supporting the math and science initiative. We're working on getting more of our own residents to finish college. You'd be surprised the number of probably people in this room that are a semester or a year short on finishing their college degrees. And because something came up, someone got sick, you got married, you had a child, something happened, and all of a sudden you step back. Well, when we do the analysis and compare ourselves to our competitive cities, they always go to that number that says, what's the percentage of people in your community who have college degrees, community college degrees, four-year degrees? How can we as a community get people to take their education and take it up a notch? If it's a GED, get to the community college. If it's a community college, get to the four-year experience. Those are important issues that we're going to have to deal with. And we're going to have a new superintendent. The first time in 13 years, this community will have a new superintendent of the Jefferson County Public Schools. I'm going to be involved in that. I'm going to be an advocate to ensure that that individual and the members of the board are engaged with this community, and we're engaged with them to ensure that they have the support to grow and expand the school system where the majority of our employees of tomorrow are being educated today. Better yet, not even to mention whatever might occur with the Supreme Court decision coming up shortly, where we as a community are going to have to either reframe our thinking, restructure our approach to education. We need to be ready to assist the school system to go through that very, very difficult, if it occurs, very difficult situation. And finally, remember that great universities and great colleges make great communities. And we've got colleges and universities in this community who have wonderful visions. They have laid out their dreams. They have energized their base. We need to support those institutions. We literally, because they will be transformational for Louisville's future also. as they bring in different type students, as they bring in brighter students, as they bring in kids from around the country who have a good experience in Louisville, and those kids stay. It gives us a base. It gives us a human resource base for the new jobs of tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. So never forget that while we're working with the community college, while we're working with the public school system, we need to appreciate and support the universities on an academic and vision basis, just as we support them on the athletic fields, to ensure that we can have the kind of vibrancy in the future and academic intelligence among the citizens of our community in the future as we want. And finally, I want to talk about what I think is the most important catalyst that will or will not transform us in a positive way in the future. You know, we're the heart of a 23-county area. We've got 1.4 million, 1.5 million in our community. We literally, when I say the heart, we're talking about both sides of the river. Three interstate highways all come together in this community, the crossroads of a significant movement of men, women, supplies, services, and goods. And for 30 years, this community has been talking about the need for new bridges across the Ohio River. The talk has gone on so long that I truly believe that simply some people have given up hope that it's ever going to come to fruition, kind of like painting the Kennedy Bridge. But I don't know why I threw that in. But I want to tell you that the bridges of Jefferson County, it's not a romance novel like the bridges of Madison County. The bridges of Jefferson County literally is going to be a transportation story, an economic development story that depends so much on how we write the next chapters as to whether it is a positive transformation and an enhancement of our economic health in the future, or unfortunately, leaves us stuck in a state of gridlock and economic stagnation. The bridge project has been around so long that there's many people who truly have forgotten the thread, the plot through the line, the thread of the plot line that goes through the story of the bridges of Jefferson County. Why do we need new bridges? Why a downtown bridge? Why a redesign of Spaghetti Junction? Why an East End bridge? Why do they all have to be done together? Well, it was more than a decade ago, folks, and many of you should remember this, that the Kentucky-Indiana Planning and Development Authority said that both bridges and the rebuild of Spaghetti Junction are critical to our community's role to ensure safe and efficient movement of goods, services, and people back and forth across the river. And that the project powers not only Louisville's economy, but it literally is the energy for this entire region of 23 to 25 counties. The folks that are relying on it, whether they're at Ford or GE, looking for the materials to get to the assembly line, whether it's in E-Town or Bowling Green, or whether it's over at Charlestown at the River Ridge Commerce Center, the old munitions plant facility. Our state has set out a schedule that will take 2 decades and $4 billion to build 2 new bridges and a redesign of Spaghetti Junction. Think about it. 2 decades to build 2 bridges and to straighten out the spaghetti in Spaghetti Junction. And yet today, national studies show that Louisville is the 3rd worst mid-sized city for traffic congestion, 3rd, and the 24th worst of all cities in the United States when it comes to traffic congestion. A new downtown bridge would rescue our already overwhelmed bridge system that today handles over 245,000 people, and if we wait to the year 2025, it will handle over 345,000 people every day. Rebuilding Spaghetti Junction and additional interchanges at Story and Frankfort Avenue would ease the congestion and dramatically improve safety. 10 years ago, we used to remind everybody that we averaged 1 accident in Spaghetti Junction every working day. Today, we average 2 accidents in Spaghetti Junction every working day. As for the East End Bridge, it would close the 5-mile gap in the I-265 loop. It serves the highest population growth area on both sides of the river. And for those of you who believe that the construction of the East End Bridge alone will solve our traffic congestion problems, the computer model simply shows it's just the opposite. If the East End Bridge were built alone, it would divert only a sliver, approximately 6% of the traffic from the downtown crossings. Only by building 2 bridges would we be able to handle the capacity needed in the future and resolve the growing congestion problems in our community. In some ways, the size and the scale of the bridge project and its challenges and its payoff reminds me, for those of you who were with us, George, in the 1980s, of the airport. I mean, think about it. We knew that our airport was inadequate. We considered various solutions. We aimed at improving our air service for the residents, and also we hoped UPS someday would expand. When we came up with the plans to add a new runway, it had a huge price tag. It had a long timeline. It was complicated, it was controversial, and not everyone was convinced we'd ever get it done. But we stuck with it. We worked through its challenge, and as you know, the airport expansion has been a catalyst not only for expanded air service, not only to provide opportunities for UPS to become the largest employer in this community, but dozens of other companies have come to this community and created investment and made investment and created jobs, all as a result of that expansion of the airport. Well, I would submit to you it's time for us to move forward on the bridges project also. And remember, it's one project, intricately linked, all three of those issues intricately linked together. The downtown bridge, the East End Bridge, and the redesign of Spaghetti Junction. It's time to turn the decades of debate and tens of millions of dollars of painstaking studies into the reality of concrete and steel. The issue is now, how fast can we do it, and how can we get it covered? How can we get the cost covered as quickly as possible? And have we, you know, we've reached a consensus, both sides of the river, two bridges, as well as Spaghetti Junction. We've won the federal approval. We got the sign-off from the Federal Highway Department. We've gone through and sought state and federal money, been reasonably successful in that area. And yet now, when the state looks out 20 years, $4 billion is the new cost of this project. And at the same time, the prospects for funding at both the state and the federal government literally are becoming more and more uncertain. So folks in Frankfurt say, well, you know, we're concerned about spending an average of 13% of the federal highway money that we get at the state of Kentucky. We're concerned about spending that 13% in Louisville, Kentucky. And yet at the same time, the state of Kentucky's Department of Transportation said, and I quote, this is a project that simply must find a way to be accomplished. We need to look at ways to accelerate the construction. We need to explore a wide range of financing options, because one thing I can tell you, my friends, the sooner we build it, the cheaper it will be. The sooner we build it, the cheaper it will be. And, you know, and we cannot let the nattering nabobs of negativism, we can't let the naysayers literally stop the flow of goods, services, and people back and forth across this river and throughout this community, all as a result of the bottleneck that is occurring today and will get worse tomorrow, and you give it 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years, and you ultimately get to the point where people are going to pass us by because you can't get through, you can't get out, you can't get your materials in, you can't get your supplies. When we consider challenges to resolve the next several years, challenges that will truly be transformational, in my judgment, the bridges and the redesign of Spaghetti Junction leads that list. It's number one. We have got to, as a community, get our shoulders to the grindstone and ensure that we get this project done. And we're going to need you, and we're going to need others like you, to engage, and some of you to re-engage. Look around this room. There are a lot of people who used to be real advocates for the necessity of this approach, two bridges and a reconstruct. And a lot of them have retired. A lot of them have moved on. And now we've got to get a new cadre of folks who understand the issues and the facts and begin to advocate. They advocate with their friends. They advocate with your neighbors. You advocate with your elected officials at the state and federal level. Just as we need to support a wide range of initiatives and projects for the parks, just as we have to ensure that the catalytic transformation opportunities that the downtown is giving us continues to go forward, just as we're in a position to ensure that education gets that drumbeat day in and day out, the bridges and the reconstructed Spaghetti Junction have got to be there. And it's my hope, if we do this right with those four priority issues, if we do this right, if we literally focus on the opportunity to bring them to fruition, to plant the seeds today so that we can water them and literally have them blossom tomorrow, then we'll be in a position to say 15 years from now, 20 years from now, as we look back, we were there, We had an opportunity. It was made very clear to us. We stepped out. We grabbed at that gold ring, and we went aggressively forward. That's what we've got to do together, folks. And together is the only way we can make the positive difference for the future of Louisville.
That was Louisville Mayor Jerry Abramson delivering his State of the City address earlier this month. When we come back, Kentucky Public Radio's Charles Compton continues his series on the need for critical thinkers among college students. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear from Roger Boyd with AAA of Kentucky about some new passport regulations in the U.S. But first, some college educators worry they're not properly preparing students for life in a world where technologies and economies evolve at the speed of electrons. Some believe their students will only adapt if they are taught how to think critically, creatively, and methodically. These concepts are not new. In fact, they helped shape the ancient culture that helped shape our society. In part two of his series, Kentucky Public Radio's Charles Compton reports on the Western world's first critical and creative thinkers.
The Western world's first educators trained the first professionals. They were known as sophists, and their students became the ancient world's lawyers and politicians. University of Kentucky philosophy professor Dave Bradshaw says sophists taught rhetoric, which was the craft of persuasion. In a sense, the sophists ran the first vocational schools.
If you wanted to go into politics, you could advance your career. If you wanted to go into law, or even if you were just in business, you could make your case in the assembly to win a contract, to win business from the state. And so that was the way to get ahead in society.
For the sophist, truth was not important. A sophist's success depended on his ability to win friends and influence ancient Greeks. Socrates, on the other hand, was only interested in the search for truth. Socrates would ask himself a question and then make methodical observations. Only after some deep consideration did he formulate an answer.
He was the one who first used philosophy to investigate human society and human life. Things like, what is justice? Or what is courage? Or what is friendship? What is the good? What is it that we should strive for in our lives? Those are the kinds of questions that he asked.
Bradshaw says Socrates involved his students in the search for truth and in the process offered them a quality education at an affordable price.
He didn't ask anyone to pay, and he didn't restrict it to the nobility. He would just go up to anyone he met on the street who was willing to talk with him and start asking him questions. Well, what do you think courage is? Would you say that so-and-so really is a model of courage? And if so, well, what is it about him? And how could we take that idea of courage and extrapolate it to other cases? So he was engaged in what people today would call the Socratic method of question and answer, trying to draw out the ideas, the beliefs, the assumptions that someone has, and to then subject them to critical scrutiny.
The Socratic method, with its emphasis on critical and creative thinking, became the basis for higher education and remained at the heart of higher education for 2,500 years. Until World War II, philosophy was an important part of every university's core curriculum. But Aaron Thompson, who's an associate vice president at Eastern Kentucky University, says higher education slipped away from its focus on critical thinking. It happened when more colleges opened their doors to more people.
As we start moving, trying to move more people through higher education, as we start looking at the process of educating more individuals, I think we've become less purposeful and more by happen chance. So moving away from purposeful to happen chance has probably taken place in the last 30 or 40 years, a little more.
Now Thompson says American educators are realizing that students who are not critical and creative thinkers are not truly educated.
You could be faced with almost any issue, any scenario, and if you're a good critical thinker, you'll be able to at least figure out how to find information on how to solve that issue if you don't already know how to use your brain in order to solve that issue. I think it's the baseline that we need to start using to judge people on if they're an educated person.
Aaron Thompson recently wrote a book on how colleges can reintroduce critical and creative thinking into every classroom, regardless of the subject matter. Such an effort is currently underway at several colleges, including Eastern Kentucky University. Tomorrow we check in on EKU's progress. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Charles Compton.
We'll continue with Part 3 in next week's edition of Studio 619. New passport regulations are in effect for Americans flying to foreign countries. Previously, those traveling by air did not need a passport to re-enter the U.S. after traveling to Canada, Mexico, South and Central America, Bermuda, and the Caribbean. The Department of Homeland Security is behind the new rules in an effort to try to cut down on the number of people illegally entering the country. AAA of Kentucky spokesperson Roger Boyd talked with WFPL's Heidi Caravan about the new rules.
Tell us a little bit about the new passport regulations that are coming into effect.
Well, basically it is a change. There used to be some places that you could visit and return to from that you did not need a valid United States passport, but that is changing. All persons, including U.S. citizens, traveling by air between the United States and typically countries that weren't recognized as needing it, Canada, Mexico, Central and South America, even Bermuda and the Caribbean, you now need to be able to present that passport.
Why the change?
Well, mostly, the security issues. Lots of people coming and going, and depending on where you connect to and where you connect from, the people in charge of, Homeland Security has primarily determined that this is going to be the best way, the most efficient way, if you will, of making sure that the people coming in the country, valid.
Are you getting many questions at AAA about the new regulations?
Well, we've actually been publicizing this for a long time. Our Home and Away magazine, we actually did an article on it in July and August of 2005, starting to get people prepared for it. It depends on the nature of the traveler. Anybody who at the last minute is planning a trip, let's say to Canada or something, they're going to be the ones that are surprised. The more seasoned the travelers, they realize not only is this going into effect, but most people also know that, having a passport is always a good idea, period, because it is a great additional piece of identification.
Do you think this is going to cause some real problems at our borders that we didn't see before?
I think it'll cause especially some initial delays, but I think the State Department as well as, organizations like AAA for that matter have gotten the word out pretty well. There should be very few surprise visitors, especially if you're from the United States. Now, maybe a little bit more difficulty, let's say that you're, originating in another country and you're coming into the United States and you're flying from Bermuda, Canada, or Mexico. They maybe haven't gotten the message out to their travelers who are inbound as well as they could have. So I think if there's any initial problems, that'll be the primary focus. It'll be people who are coming here and just don't realize that they needed this.
Now, I've noticed that there are two valid substitutes, the Nexus card and also the U.S. military Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Well, an Air Nexus card is pretty much, so in simplest of terms, is a frequent flyer card. It's a frequent traveler card that a lot of people use. The U.S. Coast Guard Merchant Mariner document, you know, that's really one. Those are very, both of those, though, are going to be very specialized. You know, somebody who gets those types of credentials, they're going to be people who do this for a living, so to speak, who are very used to going to multiple places, multiple destinations, and multiple countries, and so that's a substitute. For the average traveler, and even the one who just does it relatively casually, that passport is what to have. Don't count on anything else.
Well, I've noticed that green card, people who have green cards can go too, which is good news for me. Because I'm Canadian, and but I always have a passport, a valid passport as well. I've read that only about 25% of U.S. citizens hold valid passports. What do you think that's the case, Roger?
Well, I think that it's always been, you know, going back long ago, it's always been one of those, well, if I'm not, you know, traveling to a foreign country, I don't need anything like this. You know, here, and let's face it, we take it for granted. I mean, we're AAA here. If you've got a driver's license and a valid Social Security card, you're pretty well okay in the United States. So I think that's primarily been reserved for the people who are traveling overseas. And as we've seen up to this point, not even just overseas, but, you know, people to Canada and stuff, they never needed one. So now they do, and it's going to be a learning curve. I've always recommended, and AAA has, you know, it is an excellent form of identification. You know, it really is. Get one for yourself, get one for the kids, and, you know, then you just don't have to worry about it.
And it doesn't take a whole lot of time, although I expect there will be a backlog now because of the new regulations.
We've been doing a lot of passport photos here. I've noticed a lot of other places, you know, we do passport photos now. But, yeah, you know, really what you need, it's not very complicated. A lot of people, just by the definition, this must be complicated. You need, you know, two identical 2x2-inch photographs, driver's license or government-issued identification, a proof of citizenship, such as a birth certificate, and then, always, whenever you put letters and numbers together, an application form, the DS-11 application form. But it's really not that complicated. It's nothing that should scare anyone off. This passport requirement does not apply to U.S. citizens traveling to or returning directly from a U.S. territory. That's for the time being. But I think it's still a good idea and would strongly recommend that everybody take the extra few minutes to fill out the application form and get this. That way, you know, you're prepared to travel no matter what may happen.
That was Roger Boyd from AAA Kentucky. He spoke with WFPL's Heidi Caravan about the new passport regulations that went into effect last week. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202, or you can reach us by phone at 814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, including WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.